Hi, I'm Marion McPartland. My guest today on Piano Jazz is the legendary trumpeter, educator, funny guy, and NEA jazz master, Clark Terry. Clark got one of the best educations you can get, spending his formative years with the Ellington Orchestra and the Basie Band. He's widely considered to be one of the most influential jazz horn players of his generation, and one of the best jazz educators of our time, and one of the funniest guys to boot. He joins me on this Piano Jazz in 1994.
You?
Fine, man. Good to see you.
Oh, it's just been too long.
Oh, it sure has.
You know, I'm trying to think where the last time was that I saw you. It was really a happy occasion at the church.
Yeah, the gym's
dizzy.
True, yeah. Dizzy's right.
Yeah. Oh, God, so many things I want to ask you about. I never did know where you were from originally. You weren't from Chicago.
St. Louis is my home, yeah. I was born in St. Louis.
Well, how did you... I mean, it's as long as I've known you, you've always been one of the great players, but how did you get started playing?
I started out in St. Louis, my oldest sister, Ada, was married to Cy McPhail, who was the top tuba player at that time. You know, there was no such thing as a string bass. The tuba played the walking bass line.
Oh, that's right.
That's it. Boom, 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 boom. Right, yeah. So Cy was playing with a band in the area known as Dewey Jackson's Musical Ambassadors. And they used to rehearse at various homes of various members in the orchestra. And when I was allowed to go to listen to them, if I were a good boy, I used to enjoy it very much. And one of the guys was I was just a pre-teenager then. And one of the guys owned a candy store, and he used to bring me my favorite pieces of candy, caramel and Mary Jane's. They still make them, don't they? Mary Jane's. That's the one with the little taffy.
I don't know.
With the peanut butter inside.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, it was really good. So by him being so nice to me, him being a trumpet player, I became very closely attracted to the trumpet. Yeah.
So then did the family, did they get you a horn of your own?
Eventually, the neighbors chipped in and bought me a horn because I had made one. I couldn't afford one, so I wanted to play one. I made one out of an old garden hose, a discarded garden hose, and put an old kerosene funnel at the end of it and bound it up in three places so it looked like three valves on a trumpet with a piece of lead pipe on the other end for a mouthpiece, and I made lots of noise.
I've never heard of such a thing. My God. But that's pretty inventive. Could you actually blow notes?
Could make noise, lots of noise. But there was a method to my madness. The neighbors got sick of me playing that lousy-sounding thing, so they chipped in, and they came up with $12.50 and bought me a horn from a pawn shop.
Oh, my God. So that's how you got started.
That was my first horn.
Well, did you ever take lessons, or were you just a natural?
No, I never did. Couldn't afford it, Mary. My dad was a father of 11 kids, and it was just kind of a difficult chore for him to feed us, clothe us, and keep a roof over our heads.
My goodness.
So taking trumpet lessons was definitely out of the question.
So you really had to fend for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Ask a lot of questions, got a lot of wrong answers. I got to tell you, there's one wrong answer that I got once. I used to ask a lot of people questions, and this one old gentleman, I asked how to improve my tone in the lower register, and he said, "Son, you got a mirror at home?" I said, "Yes, sir." "Well, you go home, you sit in front of that mirror in your practice, and you grit your teeth, and you wiggle your left ear, not the right ear, but the left ear." Now, you know that's nothing that's going to help. Well, I'm naive, and I go home, and I try this. Didn't help, except that when I go somewhere to play, people would say, "Did you see that kid wiggle his left ear?"
But do you know what? I guess this is how people really make it, is that they're so determined to do something.
Yeah.
You know, if you had not been that determined and that much of a musician, I guess you would just have said, "Oh, well, I can't handle this," and you would have become a ball player or something.
Yeah.
Thank God you didn't. Well, before we go on, let's play something.
All right.
Well, you brought me this tune, and it's called The Snapper. This is one of your tunes.
Yeah?
Great title.
Oh, all right. Thank you.
All right.
That's because I'm an ichthyologist, and being involved with the fish, I happened to pick that one as the name for my favorite type of fish.
I see.
Red snapper. You know.
I'm writing that all down.
You're writing it down?
Yes,
okay.
Sure.
I'm going to ask questions later.
Gigs you did, were they with a big band or, did somebody...
Well, the first gigs I did around my hometown, St. Louis, was with small groups. There were a lot of guys who came up the river from Mississippi on the Streckford steamers, and most of them would get off in St. Louis because it's a very luring city. It had lots of things to lure the people off the boats from New Orleans. There was great cooking, there was beautiful girls, and the booze was reasonably priced.
Well, did they still have the riverboats then? I mean, was that all gone?
Oh, yeah, they had them then. As a matter of fact, there's still a few that are in existence today.
To me, that's so romantic, thinking about that.
Yeah.
Now, after a while, chronologically, I don't know what you did first. You went with Duke Ellington after a while.
Yeah.
Of course, you left St.
Well, first I was with Basie.
Oh, okay.
And we were with Basie's big band, then Basie broke up the big band and started a small band to work himself out of a bit of a debt that he'd gotten into with the Ponies.
He was sort of known for that, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, what a beautiful band he was.
Sure was.
And then I was scouted by the Ellington clan while I was with Basie to join the Ellington band, which I did. And I feel very proud to have been a person who was able to growing up a good friendship with these two guys and to work in their bands.
Both guys, so wonderful, but so different.
Yeah.
I mean, was Duke really... I mean, watching him rehearse a band and everything he did, he was always doing it, like, right up to the last minute.
Right. That's where he lived, right up to the last minute.
And he'd bring out the tune. I mean, did he really have good parts for you, or did you just sort of...
Well, you know what they used to do, Marion? He and Sweet Pea, Billy Strayhorn, when they wrote parts, they would have them copy. They didn't write for like first, second, third, fourth, fifth. They put the names on the parts because they wrote for the individuals, for their sounds. So that's why it's always been said that Ellington's band was his instrument, and he played it just like we play our axes, you know.
Well, did he have parts written for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had parts written for every individual. After I got in the band, all the new music would come in, would have my name on it, you know. And I'll never forget one time, the last arrangement that he brought in on the Sophisticated Lady. Billy Strayhorn wrote it, and we played it, and it was just gorgeous chart. So we were complimenting him, and I said, "Peace, you know, that's the most beautiful arrangement we ever heard on that tune." So his reply was, "Did you enjoy your part?" Now, how many people would be concerned about you enjoying your part? I just want to hear the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But
that's one of the funniest things I've ever heard. Oh, Jesus. It's interesting that Duke and Billy Strayhorn would think about making the parts melodic so that you'd enjoy playing it.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think that's amazing.
Yeah, they felt that if you enjoyed playing your part, you enjoyed it more. It would make for an overall better performance, you know, the whole ensemble. Yeah. It makes sense, too.
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, I'll just always remember that. Did you enjoy your part?
I'll never forget that.
You know, we should do a Duke Ellington tune. We've just been talking about him so much. Well, what would you like to do?
One of my favorites is Come Sunday.
Great. All right, let's do that.
All right.
Yeah, I'd love to hear you play with it. pretty tone. All right, let's see now. This is in
B flat, I think. Is that a good key? In B. Is just a gorgeous tune. And I remember when we used to do it on the Tonight Show, Dr. Marvel's solo on it, and somebody had written a marvelous, just straight ahead, beautiful arrangement on it. And
that was Bob Haggart, I think.
Was it?
And yeah. I was so thrilled to have that played by Doc and the band. And of course, that's the time you were in the band.
Yeah,
so
it was a good band. I enjoyed it.
You got to play. And then isn't that where you were? Originated your famous singing of mumbles.
Yeah, mumbles. Yes, it is.
How did you ever think of a thing like that?
Well, actually, it began back. It was sort of a put on of the old singers back in my hometown in St. Louis. Every other block, there was a place of refreshment, the den of iniquity, whatever you want to call it. But there was a place where people would go and have a beer, and beer was a nickel a dipper in those days, and they served it in
big tin pitchers,
you know. And every one of those joints had a pianist who played on an upright piano, which was triply laminated to withstand the weight of several stands of beer. And if you bought the piano player a beer, you could sing, and it didn't matter how horribly you might have sounded or whatever it was that you wanted to sing about. And many times you would start singing about the way you want your eggs. I want my eggs, and I'm all... By the time it gets to that second statement, nobody cares could care less about what you're singing about, how you wanted your eggs. You didn't even care if you got any eggs.
Well, did you get up and sing, or were you just imitating these people?
No, I just happened to be there. But this was on the Tonight Show. This is my opportunity to try that which I had heard all through these years. So Johnny would say, let's play this little game called Stump the Band. You know, they used to play that.
Oh, yeah,
which
right.
simply meant that somebody in the audience would suggest a tune. Which was usually a Girl Scout campfire song from 1812.
Right.
And whenever I was called on to solve the mystery tune, it was my opportunity to use this thing which I had observed in St. Louis, which we ended up calling mumbles.
Well, all right, let's do it. Let's do it so everybody knows what we're talking about. Those those few that don't, most of us do.
Spawnish gone to the wild. She did she bone the hound, the able to live up. She'll do ill, the able to let do little live up. She'll look all them down and saw and game on the ground. The hound, lady, she be doing the hound, the hound. She'll do ill, the hound, the able to live up. Live up. He won't live on the hound, the hound, the hound, the hound, the hound. She'll only live on the ground, the hound, the able to live up. She won't be down alone. She be alone, land of bound. They won't be down. They won't live up the ground. She's only bound, bound, and long and scared to be down. She'll the humble little lamb. She be born the level of the level. She keep on name on the bound and long.
To hear the full Piano Jazz broadcast, tune in next week to your NPR station. Log on to pianojazz.npr.org to find a station in your area. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. Support for Piano Jazz comes from Save America's Treasures, a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Park Service, Department of the Interior, the Friends of Piano Jazz, and NPR.